You're listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland.
Got troubles, I got them too. There isn't anything I wouldn't do for you. We stick together, can say it through, cause you got a friend in me.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Development and Events Committee meets on the third Monday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
We know a KBOO community membership is at the top of everyone's wish list this season. Give the gift of supporting grassroots community media by making a donation during KBOO's Catalog of Connections campaign now through December 31st. Our $75,000 goal will go towards everyone's favorite music, news, and public affairs programming all year long. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Thank you and happy holidays.
You're listening to Let's Talk. Let's Talk is a digital space for students at PCC experiencing disabilities to share their perspectives, ideas, and worldviews in an inclusive and accessible environment. The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the opinions or positions of Portland Community College, PCC Foundation, or KBOO FM. We broadcast biweekly on our home website, pcc.edu/DCA on Spotify and monthly on KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM.
Hello and welcome to today's Let's Talk Autism episode. I'm your host and producer, Amanda, and I was joined today by Asher, who talks about their experience growing up as a neurodivergent person in Singapore. Among the topics discussed included the openness or lack thereof surrounding disability and how attitudes differ between America and Singapore. In particular, Singapore have specific schools dedicated to autistic and other neurodivergent children, but they are treated like anyone else in the population. In comparison to America, I have repeatedly witnessed attempts to integrate us into general society, but we are often treated as invalid. It is agreed that both countries can learn from each other and that improvements for neurodivergent people can be made from both sides. Well, Hannah, thank you for being on Let's Talk Autism today. I'm the host and producer, Amanda, and I'm looking forward to having a conversation about autism in Singapore.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So let's go ahead and start this episode off with introductions. Please give your name, pronoun, major/occupation, and disability.
My name is Hannah. I go by Asher. My pronouns are she, her, and my major in occupation, at least right now, is an audio technician, but I hope to be a film producer one day. And my disability is ADHD.
Thank you. My name is Amanda. I use she, her pronouns. My major slash occupation is a part-time student, as well as applying to vet school. I hope to be a veterinarian one day, and I have high-functioning autism. So thank you again for being here today. I really am looking forward to having conversations about autism and disability in different countries. I have for a while. I did one recently with a different guest about South Korea, so I'm really looking forward to an episode about Singapore, especially with my in-laws' connection there, so this will be awesome.
For sure. Thanks for having me.
So to start off with, what is your personal connection to Singapore and when did you move to America?
So my personal connection to Singapore is my family and I moved over there when I was just about 9 years old. They basically moved us over there just for work and stuff. I moved back here to the States when I was 18, 19 years old. So for quite a bit of time, I was living in Singapore for most of my life. I moved to Singapore from Texas, so I was born in Texas.
So you said that you moved to Singapore when you were nine. If I may ask, did you grow up speaking any other languages?
I did grow up speaking Cantonese and a little bit of Mandarin at a very young age. My parents came from Hong Kong and they migrated to America, to Texas, and had me and my older brother in the States. So yeah, there was just a little bit of that Asian background going on there.
Yeah, and the reason I ask is because Malaysia and Singapore are really known for being very multicultural and diverse, and it's very common for people to speak more than three languages there, so that's kind of what made me ask. So, in terms of how autism and neurodivergence is treated in society, what is the biggest difference you have noticed in America versus Singapore?
Well, the biggest difference I've noticed in America versus Singapore is that Singapore doesn't really talk about autism or neurodivergence all too much, at least in conversation, is what I've noticed. Sure, there are some special schools for autism and neurodivergence, I believe, but I only found out about that when I became a teenager living in Singapore. Before that, even living in Singapore as a kiddo, I didn't really know anything about autism or neurodivergence or even people with special needs. It felt like it was almost a little bit hid away. And even if someone did have it, it's not that they were treated differently. They were treated the same in public, but I would not know how they were treated in private or with their family or anything like that. But here in America, I say there is like a really big voice for autism and neurodivergence as well. And there's just so much going around about just how society treats it. Honestly, when I came here to the States, only then did I start to have a little bit of more of a knowledge of autism and neurodivergence and start to learn about that.
So you mentioned you were diagnosed with ADHD. When were you diagnosed with ADHD? And was it in Singapore or America?
It was more here in the States, and it was actually pretty recently. Yeah, like I said, I only learned about autism and neurodivergence when I came here to the States. And for the longest time, I've had difficulty just staying still and just studying in school. I had issues with making friends and all sorts of other issues up until the point when I came here to the States and started going into college. And I met a couple of friends in a community, and one of them or a couple of them pointed out like, oh, do you have ADHD or do you have some sort of learning disability or something? And I'm like, no, not that I know of. And that just called to attention of, hey, I should actually get this checked out. It was just this whole process of trying to find someone to get it diagnosed and also just being very afraid because I grew up in this whole culture, Asian culture, where I guess it's just looked down upon where you're not normal. I don't really know how to describe it. I'm sure that there are a lot of Asian American people out there, families out there, kids out there that also have gone through the same thing, where there's this pressure of trying to do well in school and trying to do well in life in general. And that's what I was facing pretty much when I came here to the States. I would say that there wasn't really a pressure from my parents, so to speak, but I had placed the pressure on myself just from, I guess, just from the stereotype and just from how I grew up, just wanting to make my parents proud, wanting to make sure that I was doing well in school. But I was struggling in school and I had to do something about it.
Can I ask what your parents' reaction was after you were diagnosed? Like, would you say they were happy? Were they sad? Like, what about the rest of your family?
I didn't really come out about it. Like I said, I only figured that out recently. I would say half a year or less ago that I unofficially diagnosed with ADHD or found out that I had ADHD at least. And I did tell my brother, my older brother, about it, and he sort of had a knowledge and know-how and was supportive. I'll put it that way. But I don't know. I guess I still just have that fear of telling my parents that I do have ADHD or I do have this kind of, sounds bad, but in my mind, difficulty in learning because of that.
One thing I would say is you don't have to feel guilty about having any of your experiences or your feelings about them. Your experiences are valid. They're your own. And whether or not they reflect American Chinese or Singaporean Chinese as a whole, it doesn't really matter because they're still your experiences. So I just want to reassure you there. I'm not sure if I'm helping at all, but I believe you.
That.
I believe you, and I validate your experiences. I'm not even sure if I'm helping you.
No, you're good. I appreciate that. Yeah, it's definitely a struggle just with the culture of at least Asian culture just growing up. And I don't want to stereotype it, but there is just a lot of pressure in performing well. And having that difficulty in studying and having ADHD or autism or any kind of like disability in general, it's hard to figure out like, okay, what am I supposed to do now? Or how am I supposed to live up to what my parents have for me. Also, just going back towards the culture or society in Singapore and just how autism and neurodivergence is treated, Singapore is very competitive when it comes to schooling. Kids at a young age in Singapore, parents are already like planning on what kind of uni they're going into or what kind of high school they're going into. And you need to take all these major tests when you're about to finish a grade in school. And there's just a lot of hold on how well you do in class. So much it's a little bit like a hierarchy even in school. Students who do well get like a special tie or are called a teacher's aide, a little bit like a teacher's aide. It gives them authority too, which I wasn't a really big thing on. But yeah, anyway, I went on a complete tangent there.
Not really. I actually think that the more personal experiences you talk about in this episode, it gives context to what your answers are going to be later on in this episode and even what you've said before. It actually is interesting you talk about that, because for number four, how was autism and neurodivergence treated in Singapore in your experience? And would you say it's better or worse in America? And I know you kind of talked about that a little bit already, but would you like to expand on it?
Yeah, I'm not sure about Singapore now because it has been a hot minute since I've been back there. But like I said, there are special schools in Singapore that I have seen, whether it's for autism or neurodivergence, I'm not really sure. I've not ever really looked into it. But I would say in terms of just like how it's treated, I would say America is definitely better. At least there's like a voice for autism and for neurodivergence here in the States versus in Singapore, there's not really a way to make your thoughts known. As far as I've known, Singapore doesn't really allow for protests. And I guess freedom of speech isn't exactly implemented there as much. I think it's also just the fact that there are so many different cultures that live over there, where one person will say one thing and then another person will say something else. And there's just going to be this whole fight going on. Yeah, I would say, yeah, definitely America treats autism better.
So correct me if I'm wrong, does Singapore have a major religious body or religious authority like Malaysia does or not?
Not exactly, no. Just because of how much of a boiling pot Singapore is, there are many different kinds of religions over there. So like Christianity, Taoism, Islamic, etc. There's like temples and churches everywhere you go, pretty much. Which I guess that's what makes Singapore such a unique place. Like there's so many different cultures and so many different people all in one place.
Yeah, the reason I asked that is because just with my own experience in going to Malaysia and seeing my in-laws and how they live and obviously their culture, the biggest cultural conflict in Malaysia is usually the ethnic tensions between Chinese and Malays, and also Malaysia's under Sharia law. But I honestly don't know anything about Singapore in regards to this dynamic, so I'm just kind of curious.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not really too sure about on the religious end of things, but it is pretty peaceful over there. People just go to church or go to the temple however they want. In fact, when I was living in Singapore, the church I went to was right next to a Taoist temple, which was like right across the street. And there was never a religious fight going on in the street between the two, which I feel like was a good thing. You don't see Christians or Taoists going at each other on the streets or anything like that. Yeah, it's very peaceful. People of different backgrounds and religions just could just sit together in a hawker center or in a food court and just eat together. And it doesn't matter what you believe in or where you come from. Like at the end of the day, you're a human being.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like really happy you said Hawker Stand because I really wish my wife was in this conversation with us because she would just talk about her favorite Hawker Stand in Kuala Lumpur. Sorry, that just makes me smile because that always makes...
I love Hawkers and I can, yeah, go on about Hawkers. There's so many different foods in Singapore. It's amazing. I love
that. Was like my favorite part about Malaysia. Just, I would say that probably had the best food out of any country. My wife and I have traveled to Malaysia, definitely have the best food. Again, I really wish I had gone to Singapore when I was there just to see the contrast. And I know we're kind of getting off topic, but when I was there, there seems to be like a really big rivalry between Malaysia and Singapore. And I don't know if we want to get into that there, but whenever I was at the hotel in Malaysia, whenever someone was from Singapore, they made it a point to show off all of their duty-free bags of goodies. And they made it a point to say how they were there for a cheap weekend shopping trip.
For sure. There definitely is some history between Singapore and Malaysia. Malaysia used to own Singapore, I don't know, 70s, 80s time history.
Yeah.
Until Singapore decided to have their own country, so to speak. So yeah, I wouldn't say bad blood, but there's definitely tensions between Singapore and Malaysia. Also, just the fact that I've heard that there are some issues with getting clean water because Singapore used to get clean water from Malaysia just across the bridge through like pipelines because they are separate and no longer like the same country. There's definitely some sort of tension going on with like, oh, we want clean water, but you guys are taking clean water from us and stuff like that.
My wife like went into that before and it's like just really fascinating histories. I always think it's kind of funny because now that Singapore is its own thing, it's like one of the wealthiest countries in the world and like one of the most expensive places to live in, whereas Malaysia, I think it's getting better, but definitely isn't as financially well off as Singapore by any stretch. But then again, a lot of countries aren't. Like Singapore is ridiculously wealthy, but I also think that's really cool.
Yeah.
So, sorry.
It definitely is more of like a banking city than anything else and like a trade city.
So the next question relates to what I just asked you. But during your childhood, how did you notice that autism and neurodivergence were treated in the Singaporean Chinese culture? And this doesn't have to be in Singapore specifically. It could also be in like the American or Hong Kong culture as well. I think you might have mentioned this already, but do you know if it has changed at all?
Well, I can only speak for my own family in general, and I guess I just feel blessed that I grew up in a family that's really loving and caring and have opened their doors to every person and every background, like whatever background you come from kind of deal. Like I said, when I came here to the States, did I only know about autism and neurodivergence? But even then, when I was in Singapore, there were very rare chances where I did meet someone that had autism and they were just treated like normally. I feel like they had a lot of happiness, at least from what I could tell, which I guess was good. I say I guess, but like I said, that's in like public, but I won't speak for how they're treated in private. Whether it's changed at all, I'm sure it's gotten better. Hopefully it's gotten better. I feel like it's all about bringing awareness to people who have autism and people who have neurodivergence.
The reason I asked this question is because I was kind of wondering, say you and your family went to Singapore when you were 9, and that means that you had your primary education there, correct?
Yep, that's right.
Yeah. So I know you weren't diagnosed with ADHD at the time, but were teachers or kids, did they ever pick up on your learning difficulties or were you ever bullied or mistreated because of that, if I may ask?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, that was definitely a difficult time. I guess it also didn't help that I was the only American speaking person in the public school, in a public school for Singaporeans and Malaysians. And just the way I spoke and just the way I behaved was very strange to them, on top of just not doing very well in school. It was difficult for sure. Also, schooling system is very different from America's schooling system. So by the time I went over to Singapore at 9 years old, they were already in the middle of their final exams when I had just finished a grade, pretty much. So I had to wait a year or so before being able to enter into the next grade. And even then I had to enter like a placement test, which made me lose another year just because I wasn't able to develop very well with my mathematics or something along the lines of that. I don't really remember. Definitely I was bullied and definitely I was singled out for being the American kid and just for not doing very well in school in general. It was definitely a rough time, at least in public school, which I was very lucky. Only after 2 or 3 years in the public school, my parents just decided to take me out because my self-esteem had lowered so much just from not doing well in school. And that, I guess, also affected my mental health too. They took me out and took me into homeschooling instead, which I don't know. I wasn't sure if that was a good move or a bad move, because then I also just didn't really have any friends at all. All that to say though, is I wouldn't trade those negative times at all for anything, because it shaped me into who I am now. And it also taught me to be kind and to treat other people kinder. Taking that hard times, all that bullying, all that being singled out, taking that and turning that into just kindness towards other people. Because I've felt terrible then, and I would never want another person to feel that way either.
That's a really empathetic stance you have, because I was severely bullied when I was in middle school. I was bullied some in primary school, and I forget if Singapore counts elementary and middle school as primary school. I think they do, correct me if I'm wrong, but basically during primary school, I was severely bullied as well. I wasn't diagnosed with autism until I was 31, because in the 90s in America, it was just thought that girls and people raised as girls either didn't get autism, or if we did, it was really rare and really severe when it happened. So I just did not fit the diagnostic criteria, despite my poor mother like taking me to several different specialists to try to get me diagnosed. But they just told her I would grow out of it, which is, we both know, the worst thing you could possibly say to a parent with a neurodivergent kid, because we don't grow out of it. In fact, I would say we keep growing in our unique traits and our weirdness. Not even weirdness, we just keep being who we are, you know?
It just uniqueness, I would say.
Yeah, uniqueness. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. We blossom or turn into butterflies.
Yes, we blossom into a unique and different kind of plant. Like, I think of it this way. There are many kinds of plants in a garden, and lots of people just love to single out this unique plant. Like, it has spots. What the heck is going on with it? And when in fact, it's like the most beautiful and like most unique out of the bunch.
Yeah. The only reason I got diagnosed at all was because my wife really insisted on it when my stress level got to a point of no return. When I returned to college after a couple of years of being out of college, I officially had 3 meetings with the psychiatrist, but she told me in the first meeting she knew I was autistic. It was just required to have 3 meetings and go through the paperwork. Like, it was pretty obvious. And I don't know how it was for you when you were diagnosed with ADHD, but I just got so much closure in that moment about my childhood and just explained everything about me. And I just felt relief, because for once I didn't feel like anything was wrong with me. Like, I wasn't the problem. I wasn't stupid. Like, I was made to believe I was stupid for a really long time. I was like largely excluded from STEM careers, including veterinary medicine, because I wasn't diagnosed with autism. So I didn't get the academics support I needed. I didn't know how my brain worked. I didn't know how to study. So yeah, that really sucked. This wasn't in the questions I sent you either, but how was it for you when you were finally diagnosed with ADHD? Would you say it was also kind of relief and closure, or were you sad, or?
I guess it was a little bit of a mixture of the two. I was definitely a little bit relieved because now I had a pinpoint of what I have. But at the same time, I was also a little bit sad because just going back to the idea of the Asian culture of normalcy, or what we define as normal, or what Asian culture defines as normal, and just to be defined as not normal, it definitely scared me and made me a little bit sad. Definitely gave me anxiety whether or not to tell my parents or to tell my family that I do have this disability or this issue. But I've been taking it sort of one step at a time and just been trying to process it, also reading up and like researching as much as I can on that topic. I'm still learning, and I feel like it's definitely changed just a view on life.
Yeah. When I told my mom and my sister, they weren't surprised at all. They were like, oh yeah, this makes total sense. My mom had a lot more questions, and she wanted to know, what does this mean? Are you in therapy for anything? And just basically if there was like treatment or a cure. And I'm like, well, no, this is just how my brain is. That's who I am. This is why I'd never like smoke detectors or fire alarms or bananas, and why my sister's choice of food always sucked for me. It's like my sister, who's 6 years younger than me, she went through a phase where she only ate 6 foods, and all of which I hated. It was really funny. There was this flavor of rice-a-roni that was white cheddar and broccoli where it smelled like vomit to me. I hated that so much. And bananas. Both my mom and my sister love bananas, and I've talked so much on this podcast about how much I hate bananas.
The texture or the shape or what's wrong?
It's the texture and the smell. Like, I hate the smell. The texture is so mushy and gross and gets stuck in your mouth. And yeah, so now that everything makes sense to them now in that regard, and I don't know if this helps you, and I'm not Chinese, obviously, but it made my relationship with them improve, and they accepted it pretty readily. So I'm not sure if that helps you or not, or reassures you. Just when you're ready, it might not be as bad as you think, although maybe I shouldn't say that. probably shouldn't say that. Every family is different. Never mind. Sorry. Forget I said that.
It's okay. I appreciate just the sentiment of it all. And I believe that there is a time that I should tell them one day, sooner rather than later. It's just really getting the courage to believe that this is who I am and there's nothing wrong with it.
My wife, I love her. I really don't want to speak much on her childhood without talking to her first about this. But what I will say is her own journey with her family. There were ups and downs because she has a Chinese mom and Chinese extended family. There are good points and there are times where they really do try to help their autistic and neurodivergent family members. And they end up making it worse, in my opinion. Like, they try to shield them a lot. When anything about them comes out is different, their reaction is to shield and kind of minimize it rather than address it. I'm not sure if that helps you at all, but...
Yeah, no, I get it. I feel like
I'm trying to reassure you.
The shielding part is definitely a big one, whether it's shielding them from the outside world or shielding other people from who they are. It's the idea of like saving face, I believe.
That's yeah,
like
it is, yeah.
For at least Asian culture and Asian families and stuff, like saving face has been a big thing. Like you said, it doesn't really help that much.
So autism actually runs in my wife's mother's family. So they've known about neurodivergence in their family for a while. So that's also been interesting to observe. But they do have relatives that are fairly high needs. And there was this one incident where a female member gave a back massage to a male member of the family. And everyone got so pissed at this young woman. And I'm like, she doesn't know. You didn't tell her. I'm not saying what she did was right, but you didn't tell her that's inappropriate. You don't really let her interact normally with people. You keep treating her like she's not capable of learning. Of course she doesn't know better. That's a commonality I've noticed with like American and Asian families, and this is probably true for all families out there with neurodivergent people. They expect us to know these invisible social rules that are never explicitly explained to us.
Exactly. Yes.
And it's like supposed to read minds and adhere to all these specific cultural standards that are placed on us, and then we're yelled at when we don't meet these expectations when we didn't even know they existed initially, you know?
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of unspoken rules that feel like they need to be uplifted or not. And you're just like, all right, what's acceptable and what's not? It feels strange to ask. And at the same time, if you don't ask, it's just like, all right, what am I supposed to do?
Yeah, exactly. My wife mentioned to me that a lot of neurodivergent people actually like religious settings a lot because there are clear social rules spelled out. But I'm like, what are you talking about? Higher-ups disobey these rules all the time, and you're going to get in trouble no matter what you do. There's no reason to follow these rules because you're going to get in trouble anyways. I don't know, that's just my take on it.
I'm not sure about that, but I definitely felt a little bit more safer in a religious setting, just because that there's not really any judgment in those settings, that there's always going to be other people from other backgrounds who are probably even worse off than you. They just treat each other the same way, which I was very appreciative of.
Was autism and other neurodivergent conditions ever discussed in school or family settings?
Not exactly, no. Just because of the fact that I only knew about autism and neurodivergence when I came here to the States. It was never really publicly discussed at all. There was discussion about like the elderly and just deteriorating health and stuff like that, but never about autism or any other disabilities.
I don't remember if you said this previously in the conversation, but if a classmate or a family member had autism or other neurodivergent conditions, do you remember how they were treated or how they're treated now?
At least in public, from what I know, that they're treated pretty normally, as far as I can tell. In Singapore, at least, people that I've seen that I think had autism, or I wasn't sure if they did or not, they were treated pretty normally. There were a lot of like helper and aides in families that had individuals that had autism, and they were helped out with whatever needed to be done, like daily tasks or stuff like that. But as far as I know, they were treated pretty normally.
Do you remember what resources were available to them in Singapore, or is that not really discussed either?
Yes, there were definitely like schools for special needs and disability centers, at least from what I remember. They were called community centers in Singapore, where people who needed help with like, whether it's their low income or had a disability or need help with something or need someone to help them sign a form or something like that, they could go to those locations and they would get the help they needed. I guess as far as like in schools and stuff, there wasn't ever really a special center for the disabled or for neurodivergent, as far as I know. Yeah, no, there wasn't any kind of aid as far as I remember. This is a funny thing and also not very funny either. I guess they made up for it by having free dental care. That was the most I remember when I was in primary school in Singapore. They had a on-campus dentist that would call students in for like monthly checkups or stuff like that.
That's interesting. A dentist at school actually sounds pretty awesome. I hope they're nice, because I did not like the dentist when I was a kid.
They're okay. They unexpectedly pulled me into the office whenever I walked past, which was a bit scary to me, I guess. But they were nice as far as I remember.
That's good. So like in the schools that you went to, like the primary school you went to, they don't have any autism or neurodivergent resources. The kids were basically all just put in a different school then.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Any kids that did have special needs, they would be placed in a different school. I went into the public school in Singapore and got thrown into the deep end as a kid.
And it's interesting that you say you were made fun of as an American. It's not that I don't believe you. I just thought that was interesting because Singapore is known for being this international hotspot, basically, where a lot of countries actually send their kids there for the prestigious education system. So I would just think there'd be a lot of international kids there, like British, American,
probably
French.
In different schools. What I believe during the time was that kids that came from like other countries who were well off went to like more prestigious schools.
I see. Okay, that makes sense.
I went into like a public school that was for Singaporeans and for Malaysians, and I was pretty much the only American there.
Oh, okay, that makes sense. Okay. I don't know. This might be a little off topic, but at the time, did you have a Hong Kong Cantonese accent? Would you say that also kind of contributed to the bullying? Because I've heard that accents can play a role in that as well.
I definitely had more of a Western accent just because I went to kindergarten and elementary school when I was in the States. So I had the American accent.
Oh, I thought you said you were in Hong Kong before America. I'm sorry.
Oh, no. Okay. I went to Hong Kong every so often for vacation trips to meet relatives and stuff. And I spoke Cantonese with them.
Okay, so you do have an American accent when you speak Cantonese. Okay. My brother-in-law has that too when he speaks Cantonese and Mandarin, and it's just interesting hearing the accents difference between relatives. Like, it's very distinctive. It sounds so minimal, but it's so distinctive.
It is. It definitely is.
For number 7, what are some lessons Singapore and America can exchange with each other in terms of how autism and neurodivergence is treated in their respective societies?
That is the difficult one just because of like Singapore's laws, and I don't claim to know all the laws in Singapore, but I would say definitely in schools to provide either counseling and slash or a safe space for students with autism or neurodivergence or with a type of learning disability. Just give them like a space to go to talk to someone and to get resources to help them learn. Because many of a time when I was in Singapore as a kid and in school, we didn't have special after school remedial lessons or anything like that. Those were provided by my parents, and I feel so bad for all the tutors that I had to go through while staying in Singapore, all the math teachers that I had to go to get help for lessons I was taking in school. Just lots of lessons that just didn't stick in my brain because of that. So to have that kind of resource to help with students like myself that were having difficulties with learning or were having difficulties with keeping lessons in their mind, just to have that safe space to go to be like, hey, I'm having issues, or hey, can you help me with this homework, or hey, can you give me some skills to learn what I need to learn in today's lesson? Which, I don't know, I feel like that would change quite a bit of the culture that goes on in the Singapore schooling system, which isn't a bad thing, but definitely to have those resources available for students who are having a more difficult time in studying. As for America, just treating people normally, whether they're unique or whether they have autism or whether they have neurodivergence, just treating them normally, just like in Singapore. Like, you see all these different peoples of different backgrounds and cultures, let alone if they have autism or have a learning disability. People can just sit together in a hawker center, eat together, and you're fine. You're treated normally. That's sort of like a wish of mine for the world and for a lot of people, to just be able to sit down and have a meal with people without feeling pressured to act a certain way and just to be your true self.
Word. And also, can we just add, let's all eat at a hawker stand? I feel like hawker stands are like universal peace areas, if that makes sense. Because the food is so good, you don't really care about all the differences around you anyways, right?
Exactly.
Unless if there are like wild macaque monkeys that are trying to steal and like being jerks to you, that is like the only part of the hawker stand that would suck.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, then that's between you and the animal kingdom, but yeah.
I don't know if I'm allowed to do PSA, but just know that the monkeys will get aggressive in Malaysia and Singapore if you try to feed them.
Oh yeah, for sure. There are lots of aggressive monkeys in Singapore. I've encountered a couple of them.
Oh my god. Okay, I know this is like super off topic, but you know the Batu Caves?
Oh yes.
Okay, in the Batu Caves, when my wife and I were there with her family, there was actually like locals selling fruit to tourists, even though that is a terrible idea.
No.
The tourists think the monkeys are tame because they're not terrified of you. And I'm like, that does not mean they're tame. Those are two completely separate things, man. And I almost got attacked by a female monkey with a baby because some Australian tourist was like teasing the monkey. He was like doing this thing, like dangling the fruit up and down. And for whatever reason, they decided to take their anger out on all the humans. And I had to get down to a crouching position with the camera in front of me. And that thankfully scared the monkey off. I was scared though. Like her teeth were bore at me.
They are scary. They
like
hiss
macaques
at you.
Scare me. Like I don't think they're tourist attractions. They just scare me. Primates in general kind of terrify me. Like I've kind of said this before. If there's a primate, especially a chimp, that escapes from the zoo, I'm going to my car and just leaving the state. I'm like, nope, I'm out.
Oh yeah, no, it's
no
scary.
Chimps are terrifying. Yeah. They're like the most scary thing ever.
I didn't know that a chimps or monkeys could hiss at you. Like, I literally encountered that. I was like, okay, nice to meet you too. I'm out.
I don't know if chimps hiss, but I know that monkeys can, definitely. Like, why? Why would you want to feed those things?
Let's just find a place in the city, whether it's food carts or like a hawker center with like lots of good food and just have that.
Or let the monkeys just bother other tourists who are stupid enough to have shiny items out like a camera or a ring or a phone. I think it's hilarious. I'm a jerk a little bit, but I think it's hilarious when people are stupid enough to leave their bags down on the ground unattended in a nature park and then the monkeys are like stealing their wallet and passport and stuff. I'm a jerk, but I think that's hilarious.
I mean, you have to have your funny fix sooner or later, but yeah.
Like, dude, what are you expecting? They're not human and they're jerks. Anyways, I'm sorry. What do you want the audience to take away from this conversation?
Treat others with kindness. Everyone with kindness, I would say. No matter what circumstance or what issue they're going through, at the end of the day, kindness goes a long way. I feel like Singapore and America, individual countries, there's a lot you can learn from each other. There is a lot that they can learn from each other. People can learn from each other just in general. Just listening to the backgrounds of people and what they've gone through, whether it's childhood or whether they've grew up in another country or stayed in a country, gives like a full context of why they are who they are. I don't know if that made sense at all, but yeah, main point, kindness for sure.
No, it made sense. What I want the audience to kind of hear is similar to what you just said, but I also want to go back to the saving face thing because I don't think it's just Asian cultures that do that. Quite frankly, at least in my family, that definitely does happen too. I get it to a degree. I get that problems are hard to talk about, but the more you ignore it and the more you rug sweep, the worse it's going to get and it's not going to get better. So be open, be accepting. Even if conversations are difficult sometimes to hear, they have to happen and it's best just to listen.
Yeah.
You don't have to agree with the person you're listening to, but you have to make them feel heard. At least that's my take on it. Before we go, there actually was like one other question I wish I had asked you, but I did not include these in the question. Is there any media portrayal of neurodivergence in Singapore from what you can tell or not? Because that came up a lot in the South Korean episode I did with a different guest.
Maybe Crazy Rich Asians probably has.
Oh my God, that movie.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that's like the most well-known movie that people could probably watch and maybe have an inkling of just the culture in general and just how people are treated in general.
I don't know, was there neurodivergence in that movie?
I don't remember. It was a while back.
I just never understood why people said this was such a romantic movie. She's being bullied by a bunch of rich people, and the guy was too chicken to tell his family. He literally threw her into a shark tank.
Pretty much.
I don't see, how is this romantic? How is this guy a good match for her? She could do way better than this. I will say Constance Wu and Michelle Yeoh, though, like those two actresses, it's like you have those two actresses in a movie, you have perfection. There was a movie I watched recently on an overseas flight with my wife, Anywhere and Everywhere at Once, I think. Do you know that one?
Oh yeah, that's a good one. Yep.
Oh my God, Michelle Yeoh killed it. No matter what she's in, it's just perfection.
It's really good.
I thought she made it great. And it's interesting to see her in like that evil mother-in-law role because I'm just used to her being the good guy. Constance Wu really worked really well though as the protagonist. Did you ever watch Fresh Off the Boat?
Yes, Fresh Off the Boat is another good one too. Yeah.
I know, Fresh Off the Boat I actually thought was like, okay, this is a really good way to explain my mother-in-law. You know the character Constance Wu plays in that show actually?
Oh yes.
That is my mother-in-law almost down to a T. It's really freaking funny. You want to know what my mother-in-law is? Look at Constance Wu's character. However, Constance Wu's character is capable of apologizing.
She really is. She became a pretty good character.
I think it's really interesting how it started off as Eddie with the main character, but it shifted. That worked a lot better because Eddie, I liked Eddie okay, but he just wasn't that interesting of a character. He was funny, though. All the actors in that show were really well placed, and it's really hilarious, too. Eddie's character reminds me a lot of my brother-in-law, and yes. The two younger boys actually remind me of my wife. Like, not individually, but the two together just remind me so much of my wife. I was just wondering if neurodivergence had any kind of media representation in Singapore, but I love these shows we're talking about, too, though.
Yeah, no, they're great shows. Media in general gives people the knowledge of just how to treat autism and neurodivergence, which is good and also not good. Like, it's a double-edged sword, so
yeah,
to speak.
In the episode I had with the other guest about South Korea, we talked about several different shows that American shows were based on. Like, Good Doctor was actually based on a Korean drama. Basically, the idea is that South Korea kind of portrays autism in that super savant form, if that makes sense, where it's like they're supposedly promoting it or elevating it, but the reality is it's like they're presenting this really strict idea and really narrow scope of what autism might be, and it's not even accurate. But it also appeals to international audiences, so that's pretty brilliant, I gotta say, on South Korea's part. Gotta say, that's pretty ingenious. Sorry, going back to Fresh Off the Boat, this is a great show, and I just remember learning a lot about Chinese culture in general and just having a lot of good conversations with my mother-in-law about it. I remember this one episode, Eddie tried to introduce his girlfriend who was white, but a Chinese girl showed up to the house with a bag of oranges. I asked my mother-in-law, like, what is with the oranges? And she's like, it's supposed to represent gold.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, like, that's great. I love stuff like that.
Yeah, there's a lot of auspicious stuff when it comes to, like, giving gifts, especially in Chinese culture.
Oh, I don't give any gifts to my in-laws unless if it has my mother-in-law's approval. Like, I do love her. She and I are very different people, but I never do anything without her approval when it comes to them.
Oh, yeah. You need a lot of knowledge to know what to give to people. Even the amount of money.
Oh, yeah. Whatever she tells me to give, I just do it. I don't even question it. I don't care how much it is.
Yeah.
Really
care. Don't want to have like four of something in there because that's bad.
Oh, my God. The four thing. Oh, the four thing.
Yeah, Asian people, you guys know what I'm talking about.
Okay. I'm going to make you laugh your butt off right now. The last Chinese New Year's, my mom came over and my mother-in-law was explaining what bad numbers are with my mom. And she said 4, 6, 4.
Oh.
My mom did not get it, but I was laughing my butt off because I knew exactly. I didn't like give my mom like a force anything with 4, 6, 4, but she was explaining to my mom why you never would do that. You would never do that.
Yeah.
No, she loves my mom actually. But it's like, it's just really funny.
That is funny. Yeah, no, that's a very big no number.
Yeah, like, would you say like there's a worse number in Chinese culture or not?
3 6s is pretty bad.
I know, but not as bad as 4. Not nearly as bad as 4.
Not nearly as bad as 4, no. But 4 is definitely like the big, big no number. For
yeah.
Sure, in any kind of setting. That's why a lot of buildings in Asia, they don't have level 4 or anything.
Yeah,
like
they
that.
Don't, no. That was the hotel in Malaysia as well, actually. They did not have a 4th floor. And it's the same thing with American buildings a lot, too, where we don't have a 13th floor a lot of times, too.
Oh, yeah. The 13th floor. Yep.
I don't think we're nearly as suspicious about it. And I don't think it's nearly as funny in conversations like that, though.
No. Yeah.
So
I do know that the number 8 is like a lucky number.
Yeah. It was 8 and I want to say 9 as well,
9,
right?
Yeah.
8 and 9 are like the really good ones, right?
Yeah.
I forget what the rules are with double digits, though. I know that anything ending in 4 is bad.
Anything ending with 4 is bad. Although, I've never really heard of the idea of, like, having 40, because you have a negative and you have a positive. Does that just make it straight?
Like, I don't know. Does that mean it's, like, evened out? I still would never give a relative anything with 4 in it, whether it's starting or ending with it. I'm just never crossing that territory. I don't want to risk, like, making my mother-in-law look bad, too, especially because there's such a big language barrier with her family. And we actually really do respect my mother-in-law a lot for just making sure things go smoothly. Like, the first time I met her family in Malaysia was we went there for a family wedding and a tea ceremony for me and my wife. And we did some kind of, like, it was like a different celebration, but it involved this soup that was like really sweet with like tapioca balls in it.
Oh, it's like a dessert.
Yeah, it was like a special seasonal dessert like you only have like for celebrations. I forget what it's called though. But the thing is, I hate tapioca balls, so it's like... The problem was, the second aunt gave me it. So this is the woman who's above my mother-in-law's mother because she's the third aunt.
Oh no.
So I'm like, oh crap.
Slide it to the side, you'll be fine.
Oh no, I did drink it, and it was a very painful smile. I did do it. I did swallow the tapioca ball, and I smiled, and when she turned away, I just gave it to my wife and just made a bunch of gross faces with my face, making sure she was turned away from it. See, I'm capable of peopling. I'm capable. I just knew I was screwed there because she did not speak a word of English. I didn't speak a word of Cantonese. There was absolutely no freaking way I could have gone
down that. She just smiled at you and probably just said like, oh, eat more or something. That's probably
didn't even do that. She just gave me the kind grandma smile. But at that point, I knew what the hierarchy was with the women, obviously. So I knew I couldn't say no. I knew what the hierarchy was. I was screwed. I even met like the first aunt too. She actually seemed really nice. Like she was actually pretty easygoing compared to my mother-in-law. It was actually really funny. I thought like all the really important people were actually more easygoing than my mother-in-law.
That's good. That's nice. I have so many relatives, I can't even remember how to call them correctly, let alone in Cantonese, honestly.
I just know that the older someone is, the more authority they have. Again, I still don't speak a word of Cantonese, sadly, but I just do whatever my mother-in-law says. That's just my default mode when I interact with her family, with the older members of her family. I'm just doing That's what good. You say. If you have time, I have a hilarious travel story involving whiskey.
Oh, I definitely have time.
I want to also give you some context. This is my first time out of the U.S., period. So this is my first time leaving the U.S. I did have a passport because we were initially going to go to Canada for a different trip when I was younger, but that never ended up happening. So I did have a passport. This is the first time I'm meeting my mother-in-law's family. So she was like picking out outfits, making sure I had like right dresses and everything. But the thing that was like tipping me over the edge with her control was these three whiskey bottles that we were supposed to bring to a wedding. Because as you know, in Malaysia, there's Sharia law and it's pretty unsafe to trust the booze there. Anyway, she told me to like pack one of the whiskey bottles in the suitcase and I'm like, no, it might break. It might get all over my clothes. And it's like, I don't even drink anyway. Mother-in-law, just pack it in your bag. At the time, she just kept pushing and she didn't tell me why. And eventually, I forget if I found this out later after we got there, but basically there's like a one person limit per bottle of whiskey or a bottle of alcohol or something. Anyway, she was freaking me out because she kept saying, do not make eye contact with the security. I was freaking out. I'm like, oh my god,
something
I get
illegal. Yeah, no, you're and doing it's like something illegal.
I knew that Malaysia was Sharia law, and she had told me you can't really expose too much skin, yada yada. So I already knew that alcohol was mostly a no-no there, or like half a no-no. But I don't know. I just know that alcohol was kind of on the borderline there.
Yeah.
So I was really scared I was going to get arrested in Malaysia. So my first experience going to another country was me freaking out for over 12 hours, thinking I was going to get arrested.
No, I mean, the most that they'll do is just fine you, honestly.
I flat out told my mother-in-law and my wife, if I get questioned by airport security or like border control or whatever, I'm throwing you guys under the bus. I did not even want to bring... Oh no, I flat out told them, no, I didn't even want to bring the stupid alcohol. I'm not kidding. I'm not lying. I don't drink. I was worried it was going to get all over my clothes initially because I was worried the glass bottle would break in that stupid plane. I'm like, oh no, if I get arrested, I'm selling you guys down the river. Nope, not happening.
Yeah, no, you wouldn't get arrested, at least from what I know. You would just get fined.
Yeah, they'll just either fine me or take the whiskey, one of the two.
One of the two, yeah, exactly.
I wanted them to take the whiskey, honestly. No, I'm petty. I would have wanted them to take the whiskey. In fact, here, you want this? I'll pay the fine and you can have it. This is my mother-in-law's fault. I didn't even want to bring this stupid thing. My mother-in-law and my wife get really annoyed at me with that story because I keep saying the word smuggling.
Oh.
And we weren't smuggling, to be clear, but I always like to describe it as that because we really were being so covert about it. It's like just hidden under our clothes. It was like I couldn't talk to anyone. Oh, yeah. I don't make eye contact. Sure. It was really funny when we got there. Airport security literally just looked at me and they said, okay, you guys are good. Apparently I'm like the most harmless looking white woman ever.
I mean, maybe if you were a guy that would be different, but
I don't know. I'm not a quiet person, as you know, and I very clearly have an American accent, so I don't know, maybe that's what got us through. I don't know. So that brings us to end of our conversation. Thank you so much for joining me today, Asher. I hope you have a great day. I
appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. I hope you enjoy the conversation between Asher and I in discussing different aspects of growing up neurodivergent. We went through public school systems that failed to meet our education or emotional needs, with neither of us diagnosed as children. Whether it was for saving face or other cultural reasons, autism and neurodivergence as a whole is acknowledged in Singapore, but is generally not discussed outside of designated spaces. In America, I feel as though disability culture is frequently discussed, but we are disregarded as invalid when we try to advocate for our needs. Overall, I enjoyed the conversation with Asher today, and I hope you listened to her message in practicing empathy and listening to people's stories. Thank you for listening, and be sure to tune in for the next episode.
Thank you for listening to Let's Talk, Portland Community College's broadcast about disability culture.
Find more information and resources concerning this episode and others at pcc.edu/DCA. This episode was produced by the Let's Talk Podcast Collective as a collaborative effort between students, the Accessible Education and Disability Resources Department, and the PCC Multimedia Department. We air new episodes bi-weekly on our home website, our Spotify channel, and monthly on KBOO Community Radio 90.7.
Welcome to World Ocean Radio. I'm Peter Neal, director of the World Ocean Observatory. I'm often asked to describe the purpose of the World Ocean Observatory, to articulate a credo, a statement of beliefs by which to guide our actions. In response, here is a list of intentions: to change the way we see the world, to focus perspective and motivation beyond self to others, beyond consumption to conservation, beyond conflict to civility, beyond denial and intolerance to acknowledgement and engagement, to celebrate a continuum of water from fresh to salt, from the mountaintop to the abyssal plain, as locus of and process for a new system of values, structures, and behaviors, to promote the connections between the ocean and human health, food, energy, security, community, and culture as a dynamic system uniting land and sea, to extend knowledge to action through the promotion of science, policy, education, and communication as a means for global unification and peace, to build a circle of citizens of the ocean worldwide as a constituency for political will and social change, to advance a vision of a new hydraulic society as a response to the existential challenge of climate change and as a transformational model for human relation and endeavor united and sustained by water, to articulate a plan by which to relate the asset value of the ocean to global finance, law, governance, cooperation, equity, and justice as an evolutionary process toward a viable, benevolent, enduring society, to shift public understanding and engagement to support of such a plan for the near and long-term benefit of future generations, indeed for all mankind, to advance the conservation and sustainability of oceanic systems as the best methodology for and political response to our critical need for transformational change, to embrace water, the most essential natural resource on Earth, as the primary force for the future of ourselves, families, communities, and nation-states, for the continuity of human enterprise, creativity, and survival. I'm often asked, what can I do? There is a suggestion of hopelessness in the question, as if the problems are so large and an individual's ability to act effectively so small as to paralyze any possibility of successful engagement. My answer is, pick one. Pick one thing that you think should and can be done within your place and your capacity, then pursue it with relentless intensity using any and all means available. You see such determination around us often. One person on a mission to create, organize, finance, pursue what may seem an impossible goal, yet achieved one way or another as an outcome, a realization of intent that drives change for the better. The World Ocean Observatory goals may seem too ambitious, too grandiose to be possible. I argue not. The fact is that the information required to achieve incremental progress is readily available. The technology via radio, podcast, and social media offers economical, efficient, and effective means to amplify any message, virtually unlimited broadcast that can and does reach measurably millions worldwide, connection that transmit ideas and stimulate connections often with enthusiastic reply and endorsement. We are so privileged to have such an opportunity to express our views freely and with effect. We vote, an equally powerful collective act of intention. We meet to combine and apply our ideas toward goals local and abroad. We come together to organize an event, to support an institution, to share our aspirations through collective engagement and responsibility. We make change, however incremental, however impossible at first it may seem. Pick one thing. World Ocean Observatory is my choice. A credo? A plan of action? To change the way we see the world? Why not? To embrace water, the most essential natural resource on Earth, the primary force for the future of ourselves, families, communities, and nation-states, For the continuity of human enterprise, creativity, and survival? Why not? The connection we know and feel in this moment, through the airwaves and internet, as a means to share ideas and innovations worldwide? Why not? Thanks for listening. Thanks for being a citizen of the ocean. We will discuss these issues and more in future editions.
There is no sense in house music.
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM and streaming on the web, kboo.fm. I'm Don Jacobson, and moving on, we'll be here in just a few minutes right after the news.